and welcome to the November 3rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin. It's a crisp fall morning here in Park City.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone. Yeah, it is. It's a little chilly. Had some ice outside, like I have for the past week, I believe.
Anyway, it's a Monday after a spectacular Halloween here in Park City. You know, there are a few things that are uniquely Park City in this town, and one of them is Halloween on Main Street. You see lots and lots of people. You see lots and lots of fabulous costumes. You know, I know that I had the high point for me of Friday afternoon was that I was doing a stand-up hit with Claire Wiley, where we were talking on the radio, and a little kid walked up to us in the middle and says, "I'm lost." And we managed to do a live lost and found recovery right here on KPCW.
A live lost and found with an actual...
We found the mom. It was awesome.
And it didn't have to go up on our website. It
didn't have time.
That is perfect. So what do we got coming up today, Rog?
We're going to start our day by talking with author Peter Cousins. He has a new book called Deadwood, Gold, Guns, and Greed in the American West. It's a different story than what you saw on that wonderful HBO show. It's a really fascinating tale, lots of colorful characters.
And then next up, we have John Waldron. Yep, that John Waldron. He is the president and COO of Goldman Sachs, and he's here to talk about the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses Program, which launched last week. And we'll finish our show by speaking with our very own president and general manager, Juliana Alley, about Live PC, Give PC coming up this weekend.
Some of the names survive in popular culture to this day. Calamity Jane, Wild Bill Hickok, and thanks to the HBO series of the same name, even Al Swearingen. The town was Deadwood. And author Peter Cousins has a new book chronicling the story of the boom town that was Deadwood in the 1870s in his new book, Deadwood, Gold, Guns, and Greed in the American West. We're very lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Peter. Thanks for being with us.
Morning. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
So, Peter, let's start with why this book. What motivated you to write the book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, I wanted to return to the West after having done a couple of books on the Indian Wars east of the Mississippi, and I'd already done a book on the Indian Wars of the West. And I decided, you know, I'd had enough of wars for a while, but I still wanted to write something on the West, and I wanted to concentrate on what life was like in the Wild West. And Deadwood seemed the natural place to go. You know, one of the so-called triumvirate of iconic Wild West towns, along with Tombstone and Dodge City. But to me, it was the greater draw of the three, because not only was there an inherently more wild and lawless atmosphere to the town, but the town itself, and this is something I can't stress enough, the town itself, for the first year or more of its existence, was intrinsically lawless. It was the only town that I know of in the history of the United States that was built on land that had been given to the Indians in perpetuity by treaty. And so everyone in Deadwood and the Black Hills in general during the 1876 Gold Rush were illegal squatters on Indian land. That means they were not subject to any federal, state, or territorial laws, and there was no law except what they made for themselves. And that, in particular, drew me to the story. How do people behave in an inherently lawless environment?
So let's pull back a little bit and just talk about, you know, the history of the relationship between the U.S. government and the Native American tribes in the area that became Deadwood. Can you just sort of lay out the groundwork about the treaties and what was supposed to have happened in that area?
Sure. In fact, the flight of the Lakota Sioux, or the Indians, of which we're talking about, is a subsidiary theme throughout my book and quite a poignant story. The Lakota Sioux were masters of the Northern Plains, and the entire area that is now South Dakota and North Dakota and the better part of Montana were the home of the Lakota Sioux. The Black Hills had been granted them as part of what was called the Great Sioux Reservation by treaty in 1868, after the Lakota had badly beaten the U.S. Army in what's called Red Clouds War. And as a consequence, they recorded this large reservation, enormous reservation, of which the Black Hills were part. Everything went well until 1874. There had been rumors, long been rumors of gold in the Black Hills, unverified rumors. In 1874, George Armstrong Custer was sent on an expedition into the Black Hills, ostensibly to locate a spot for a military post, but he also took some so-called practical miners along with him, which you don't usually do if you're just looking for a site for a military post. And sure enough, they discovered gold in small quantities, but the newspaper men who were along magnified that into a huge gold strike. Gold seekers started to penetrate the Black Hills despite the Army's half-hearted effort to keep them out. The Lakota were remarkably restrained. They did not see this as a sufficient provocation for war. They hoped the government would resolve this for them.
Did they go to the government to get them to get the white men out of there?
Oh, absolutely. They pleaded repeatedly, and the Army's response was to set up a cordon around the Black Hills, but again, some of the commanders were half-hearted in their enforcement of it, and even those who really tried to keep squatters out and turn back caravans of would-be miners, the problem was the Army was too small and the area was too great. I mean, it was easy to elude the Army and penetrate the Black Hills. In fact, one of the great Lakota chiefs, Spotted Tail, even went into the Black Hills with an Army general and pleaded with the miners to please leave. I mean, they exercised great restraint.
And the power of gold was pretty significant. I guess one part of the story is the interaction between the U.S. government and the Sioux. Another part of the story, we're talking about the pull of gold. There's also the push of the economic conditions in this country in the 1870s.
Right. The country had suffered what was called the Panic of 1873, which in many ways was equivalent to the 1929 Depression in terms of the impact on the economy. And it still was very much a factor in 1874, 75, and 76, when all these events we just talked about transpired. And you had a lot of jobless men who were looking for a new start or the main chance. And the prospect of getting rich overnight on gold in the Black Hills was quite an inducement. In fact, one would-be miner made a comment. He said, "How can one sit at home idly when there's gold just 500 miles away?"
Okay, so what actually triggers the settlement of Deadwood? What are the events that sort of lead to what becomes an explosive growth in this little town in the middle of nowhere?
Well, during the year of 1875, miners had again penetrated the Black Hills illegally and in pretty large numbers. They initially gravitated to the spot where Custer discovered gold, and that was in the central Black Hills. They found, though, that it wasn't there in paying quantities. It wasn't there in a quantity sufficient to justify mining. So they started drifting north, looking for other gold deposits. And in December 1875, a handful of miners stumbled on a good quantity of gold in what's called Whitewood Creek on the site of what became Deadwood. And it's remarkable, from this handful of miners in December 1875, they worded their gold discovery got out so quickly that by April 1876, you had almost 5,000 miners congregated in the area that became Deadwood. It was explosive and completely disorganized growth. You had tents, shanties, wiki-ups, every kind of shelter you can imagine, just strewn helter-skelter along this gulch that became Deadwood.
Now, if there was no federal law in the area, then they didn't really have to stake a claim and file it at an office.
They staked claims, and they did file locally and tried to bring some order out of the chaos, and they established some... They tried to apply prevailing mining laws in staking claims, but the problem was, and this became a real serious problem after Deadwood was incorporated into the Dakota Territory, these claims had no legal standing. And so you ended up having people that got that got really rich in Deadwood were the lawyers, because you had a multitude of lawsuits over the legitimacy of these claims. Fortunately, the majority of the claims cases were settled in court, but there was a fair number that were settled by gunplay.
So we have this explosive growth pattern as the word gets out. Tell us a little bit about what life was like in Deadwood during this heyday in the, what were we, late 1876, early 1877?
1876, throughout 1876 into 1877, and actually through 1879, but the heyday of the law, the lawlessness, when it, before it became part of the Dakota Territory, and the lawlessness continued afterwards, because frankly, the Lakota Territory had a good deal of lawlessness. This was, after all, the peak of the Wild West, 1870s. It was kind of a bifurcated community. You had one part of Deadwood that sought lawfulness, that sought to establish some kind of a sense of order. This would be the business element in particular, that hoped this would be a long-term concern and knew it would be only if they could bring some order out of the chaos and tried to establish some sort of local law. Then you had the Al Swearengen element. You had the wild part of Deadwood with gambling halls and saloons open 24/7, con men on the street, prostitutes on the street, brothels everywhere you turned a corner. And it was kind of a battle for Deadwood's soul between these two elements. And for quite some time, the Al Swearengen element, so to speak, seem to be winning out.
Hey, let's talk about Al Swearengen, because he is this in the HBO series that so many of us have seen, he's this marvelous central villain character. Was he really that bad? And how big was his influence and organization?
He was even worse. In the HBO series, there are some moments when he actually displays a bit of humanity, and you kind of feel a little bit of sympathy for him. The real-life Al Swearengen had absolutely nothing to recommend him. He ran a place called the Gem Saloon, which was the principal purveyor of sin, so to speak, in Deadwood. He had quite a bevy of prostitutes in the saloon. He recruited prostitutes from Chicago and elsewhere through newspaper ads misrepresenting the kind of work they'd have. And the real-life Swearengen was actually married. In the show, he was depicted as single. He was married, and he compelled his wife to help him procure girls. And when she was at all reluctant, he beat her to a pulp. And she eventually got tired of him and filed for divorce. His next wife suffered the same treatment. He had absolutely nothing going for him in a positive sense. And he was sort of the face of sin in what was called the Badlands portion of Deadwood. Portion of Deadwood that is portrayed in a TV show, and portrayed very accurately, I think.
And meanwhile, you mentioned that there were elements, and oftentimes when you read about gold rush towns or even oil boom towns, the people who really make money are the people who figure it out that they want to sell supplies to the people who are actually doing the mining. Was that the case in Deadwood as well? Was the sort of law and order, middle class, mercantile community, the people who were purveying supplies?
Well, it was a combination of that and actually the so-called purveyors of sin. I talk about people coming to Deadwood, both legitimately and otherwise, to mine the miners. And it was actually the lure of gambling and prostitution and things of that nature that was really the biggest moneymaker for people who were not mining. I mean, most of these miners were guileless, naive sorts. A few were professional miners who had roamed the West since the California gold rush, but the majority, you know, were quite naive. And as quickly as they took gold out of their claims, they took their gold dust to the nearest saloon or gambling hall or house of prostitution and spent it. Very, very few miners actually got rich on gold. The gold dust just kind of sifted through their hands as quickly as they made it, and it was the Swearengens and others who really made a killing. The purveyors of supplies, people like Seth Bullock and his partner Sol Starr, who are portrayed front and center in the HBO series, they did a good, steady business, legitimate business. But it was people like Swearengen, they pulled in, you know, $10,000 a night sometimes, which is you know, equivalent of more than $100,000 a night. Now, in Swearingen's case, a lot of it went to his backers and sort of like the mob. You never quite knew what happened to the money. But it was quite a lucrative business.
Well, let's jump into someone else. Let's jump into Calamity Jane. Can you share a little bit about the real Calamity Jane? You know, far more complex character than expected.
She was a very enigmatic character, and she actually became a legend not only in her own lifetime, but before the age of 22. She first came to Deadwood as part of Wild Bill Hickok's entourage in mid-1876. And it was kind of funny how she became part of Wild Bill's entourage. His caravan, it was a caravan that he and a partner of him named Charlie Utter had put together. And they paused at Fort Laramie outside of Cheyenne. And their caravan consisted of so-called soiled doves, prostitutes, gamblers, and other questionable sorts. And the officer of the day at Fort Laramie said, "Hey, would you mind taking another soiled dove off our hands?" And he led Wild Bill and Charlie Utter to the guardhouse. And there was this young woman just out of her teens lying there half naked and drunk. And so they agreed to take her along, and they dressed her up in buckskin and took her to Deadwood. And that was Calamity Jane. And no sooner did she get there than she became probably the most flamboyant of all the prostitutes in Deadwood. I mean, she was more than just a soiled dove. She also made a name for herself by helping nurse smallpox victims in 1876 when a smallpox epidemic broke out and no one else would go near them. And she was quite a self-promoter. And to fast forward, in 1877, A journalist came to Deadwood looking to write a book on the Black Hills, kind of a promotional book to draw more interest to the area. And the book he wrote was called America's Wonderland. And you open this book, and front and center, there's a full-page portrait of Calamity Jane, this woman in buckskin with six guns in either hand. And this author bought her story, hook, line, and sinker, that she had... She'd been an Army scout. She fought against the Indians with the Army. She was a experienced herder. She'd been at one time married to a rich rancher, et cetera, et cetera. And in this book, he portrayed her as kind of the heroine of Deadwood. And that led to other journalists who came to Deadwood who interviewed her, perhaps horizontally, I don't know. But... Who portrayed her in the same light as this kind of poor woman who was forced into prostitution by circumstances, which was not entirely incorrect, but turned her into a heroine. And then the dime novelists, who were sort of the pulp fiction writers of the day, picked up on that. And the second most popular dime novel character of that time was a fellow named Deadwood Dick, a fictitious stagecoach robber. And his heroine sidekick, who appeared in half the novels, almost half the novels, was Calamity Jane. And this was during 1877, 78, and people in Deadwood were mystified how this, they thought was a common harlot, had become this legendary figure already.
So they didn't know Deadwood Dick was a fictional character.
People out east didn't. Yeah. I mean, people out east, and it contributed to the mystique of Deadwood, which played itself out in the Eastern press. In fact, one of the leading New York papers called Deadwood the most diabolical town on earth. And the New York Times had similar commentary on Deadwood. So people developed this notion of Deadwood based largely on the Deadwood Dick novels and journalistic excesses. I mean, Deadwood was a wild town, but it became even wilder in popular imagination. So even during the time all these events were playing out, it was a legendary town throughout the country.
You know, Lee Marvin won an Oscar by playing a broken-down gunfighter in Cat Blue. And as I was reading about your description of Wild Bill Hickok and how he enters the Deadwood scene, it sort of reminded me of that. The Wild Bill Hickok portrayed in the book and at the time of this is really kind of a sad character, isn't he?
Yeah, Wild Bill Hickok had made a name for himself as a lawman in Kansas. And he was turned into a legend in his own time, once again, by a journalist, in this case, a journalist looking for a frontier hero to create. His fame and his time in Kansas, this last lasted maybe a half dozen years until Kansans got tired of his brand of law enforcement, which was to shoot first and ask questions later. And by the mid-1870s, he was out of Kansas. He was drifting, gambling, drinking. And he saw in the Black Hills Gold Rush, and he was about 38 years old. His eyesight was failing him, too. And
that, of course, which is pretty important for a gunfighter.
Yeah, it's pretty essential. That and a quick draw. Maybe even more essential than a quick draw. And so he thought he'd found in the Black Hills Gold Rush a chance to make it gambling. So he traveled along with his friend Charlie Utter to the Black Hills. Yeah, again, he was broken down by then. He was taking quack medicinery for his eyesight. He was the shadow of the man he'd been. And just gravitated from poker game to poker game until, and not to spoil the story, he was assassinated by a drifter who, I think, I conclude, just wanted to make a name for himself.
And, of course, the legendary death of Wild Hickok involves a particular poker hand that became known as the Dead Man's Hand. And the question is, was that really what he was holding?
I don't think so. I don't think he was even holding a hand. From the most reliable accounts, he had just lost a hand. Perhaps his last words, or close to them, was, you old duffer, you beat me again. And he slammed his hand down on the table, and they began dealing another hand. It was at that point that Jack McCall, the assassin, came up behind him and said something to the effect of, take that, you son of a bitch, and shot him in the back of the head. Hickok's, I mean, it was pretty gory. I mean, Hickok's, you know, head exploded, brains scatter all over the table, blood all over the table, and he hit his head on the table and then fell on the floor. And I don't think he was holding a hand. And in all the chaos that ensued, I don't think anybody would have looked at a bloodstained poker hand to see what it was either. You know, not the thing you would focus on, particularly when McCall was trying to squeeze off other rounds at bystanders. The story was first told in the 1920s mm-hmm. by a guy who actually was there, Doc Pierce, a famous purveyor of tall tales. And he started that story in the 1920s. So it was picked up by Wild Bill Hickok's leading biographer, who in a subsequent edition of the book said, you know what, I think I was wrong here. I think this is all legend. But they still purvey that legend in Deadwood. Makes for a good story in the casinos.
Yeah, in the tourist town that's Deadwood today.
Oh, yeah, it's tourist town. So what do you hope readers take away from Deadwood, and what do you think the story says about the broader American character?
I hope they take away, of course, what I think is a rousing good story of what life was like in the Wild West, not only for the element that we've discussed, but, you know, I try to convey what everyday life was like for the Chinese in Deadwood, for women in Deadwood, for the common person. I want people to take away from the story what I think is a basic part of the American experience, and that is the search for wealth, the search for quick wealth, easy wealth, mm-hmm. fast money. And also, how Americans behave in a situation of lawlessness, and how they can come together as a community despite that. So the combination of those two things.
So now, if there was one major misconception that we have about Deadwood, just one, what would that be?
That there was no effort at establishing law and order, that it was just simply a wide open town. There was enough of that to make for really exciting reading, but that wasn't all there was to Deadwood.
The book is Deadwood, Gold, Guns, and Greed in the American West. We've been lucky to be spending time with author Peter Cousins. Peter, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks so much for having me.
Goldman Sachs is a giant in the financial world with global operations in a wide range of sectors. But today, we're joined by President and CEO John Waldron to talk about a Goldman Sachs program that focuses on small business. Good morning, John, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So a few days ago, Goldman Sachs welcomed 40 entrepreneurs in the newest class of the 10,000 Small Business Program. First of all, tell us what the Small Business Program is.
We're thrilled to be engaged in the small business program. We've been engaged for a long time in this program. It's really a program focused on building educational capability and business building skills for small business owners across the United States and around the world. It's a program that includes a one-year curriculum that we had developed in partnership with Babson and is administered in various cities and now states around the country and around the world, focused on, as I said, business building skills, business planning, marketing, scaling your business, and you know, running your business more effectively. We typically administer the program through a partnership with community colleges, who are important local partners to make sure that the program is administered, you know, effectively, using that Babson curriculum as the kind of underlying foundational curriculum. And, you know, we offer financial support in many respects in terms of grants and other capability, you know, capacity enhancing capabilities. And obviously there's a lot of educational component to it to make sure that the small business owners are learning the skills that are important for them to grow and scale their business. And then we create metrics as they run through the program and graduate from the program. We stay very connected with them and create metrics that track their progress over time. And, you know, we're thrilled to see how many jobs have been created and how much economic value has been generated by virtue of our running this program.
So John, the term Goldman Sachs is commonly associated with big business. So why is it important for the company to sponsor a program of this type?
Well, when you think about the U.S. economy, let's just focus on the U.S. for the moment. Probably over half of the economy, whether from a job creation standpoint or economic impact standpoint, comes from small business. And obviously, Goldman Sachs, as you rightly point out, historically has been servicing more of the large business, you know, component of the economy. And we felt like this was a great way for us to find our voice and our capability to do what we can to serve the small business part of the economy, which, as I said, is over half the economy. And so small businesses propel and drive a lot of job creation, a lot of economic impact in the country, and are super important for communities around the country. And so we wanted to lend a hand and use some of our capital, and more importantly, some of our intellectual capital and support, and also give a voice. I think an important component of this is our ability to give a voice to small business owners who often struggle to have their voice heard as loudly as large business owners are able to do, whether it's in Washington or in their local communities and states. And so I think that's an important part of this program in terms of our ability to give them that voice.
Now, we are particularly interested in the local aspects of the program here in Northern Utah. How long has Goldman Sachs been a part of Utah?
We just celebrated our 25th year anniversary. We are celebrating our 25th year anniversary this year. I was recently in Salt Lake to participate in what's been a year-long celebration of our 25th year anniversary. In fact, when I was in Salt Lake, we welcomed the new cohort of 40 small business owners that are, you know, our 2025 cohort, which is focused on rural Utah. So we started our program in Salt Lake, as we often do in a city. More recently, we've been focused on growing our rural program to make sure that we're servicing not just the cities in the country, but actually the rural component in the country, which, as you know, is a very important part of economic activity in America. And so we're 25 years into Salt Lake. It's been a wonderful, highly successful experience for us as a firm. And in our small business program, we've been very successful. I believe we now have small business owners, over 1,000 graduates from our small business program in Utah, I believe generating $2 billion of economic impact in the state. So you know, that's pretty powerful in terms of the impact these small business owners have and the small bit we can do to make sure that they're successful.
Yeah, that is quite substantial.
Okay, so for the listener who's hearing about this and hearing those rather impressive numbers, can we help give them a sense of how the program actually works for a business owner? How do they participate? And how do they, are they able to keep doing their business while they're participating?
Yeah, I mean, the challenge for the small business owners is they have to kind of walk and chew gum at the same time. They have to run their business.
Yep.
While going through this program. Yeah, one of the pieces of advice we often give small business owners is to try to figure out how they can create some leverage for themselves and their business, which is not always easy. You know, mm-hmm. It's much easier for those of us in these larger companies to be able to do that. But they go through a pretty intensive curriculum, as I said, where you know, we try to make it reasonable for them to do it in short, intense you know, period, so that they don't take too much time away from their business. And, you know, we administer it on these community college campuses, which usually is not too far away from where their business is situated, and they can plan their weeks and their months around that. And we try not to be too intrusive, but we definitely want them to go through, you know, the intensity of that program, because that's the value proposition. The other thing I would say is there's a lot of networking. So, you know, we tend to encourage networking between the small business owners, which we think is an important component of the program. So they're learning as much from each other as they are from the actual curriculum.
So this is it sounds like an outstanding program, and I imagine it's extremely difficult to get accepted. What are some of the criteria for acceptance?
We like businesses that look and, I mean, affect, I should take a half a step back. The key component of the program is to essentially come up with a growth plan. So really what we're trying to do here is we're trying to enable these businesses to grow and scale. I mean, the hardest thing, I think, for a small business owner is to scale. You know, they may lack capital, they may lack talent, they may lack the business building capabilities, hiring capabilities, and so forth. So what we're looking for in the interview process is obviously a business that looks like it has, you know, some foundational success and is looking to scale. So it's business owners that are showing a desire and appetite to learn how to grow their business, not just manage their business. That's kind of fundamentally the most important thing is you know, businesses that we think have the capacity to scale, and that with some capability building in, you know, in the program, we can teach them how to scale. Fundamentally, the difference maker.
You know, it's an obvious truism that every big business began as a small business. And we've just been talking about the importance of the potential to grow. Are there any sort of superstar stories that you can tell about businesses either here in Utah or otherwise that have been a success as having gone through this program and have grown?
I'll relate to one story which is fresh in my mind, which is this business that I visited when I was in Salt Lake called Caddis Enterprises, K-A-D-D-A-S, run by a woman named Natalie Caddis. This is a family business that I believe was founded, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you know, was a nice business that had grown reasonably over time, but had not really scaled, you know, in a super meaningful way. And, you know, Natalie went through the program. I think she was in our first cohort in Salt Lake. And, you know, this is a business that actually makes kind of safety equipment and protective equipment for utilities, utility poles, you know, kind of power. It's sort of protective equipment for all things power. It's a manufacturing business. And, you know, she went through the program, had a growth plan. The growth plan, I think, was partially to go global and partially to go deeper, you know, in some of her end markets in the United States. And so she built a plan to do that. She built a plan to grow her capacity to distribute more of the products, so to build a bigger distribution capability, to build a bigger manufacturing capacity, to buy equipment that would be more automated equipment using some more robotics, be able to deliver the product, you know, at a lower price, you know, with lower cost and higher throughput. You know, as I've gotten to know Natalie, she's now expanded, and I got a tour of her facility just recently. She expanded her manufacturing plant significantly. She's bought a lot of robotics capability. The facility is unbelievable, and she's generating, you know, enormously higher revenue with a much more global business than she had, you know, at the time she went through our program. So that's a super impressive success story. I believe Natalie is now on the board of the San Francisco Fed as the small business, the small business owner representative, you know, which is obviously terrific for her and a great story for us to demonstrate, you know, kind of what can happen to a small business owner who's obviously done very, very well and now has a voice that can carry much broader than, you know, just in our local community.
Okay, so that's the manufacturing sector. What are some other sectors that some of these businesses come into the program from?
All sectors, a lot of services. Okay. Obviously, the American economy is increasingly a service-based economy. So you get businesses that are, you know, that are in food service, catering, hospitality, hospitality services, right? Maybe delivering, you know, materials or service for the hospitality sector more broadly, government service. So it touches a broad swath of industries all over, you know, all over the economy. And increasingly, I would say more services, because obviously the economy is more of a service economy, certainly has been for quite some time now.
And with the recent movement of AI, have you had any AI businesses come into the program?
We've not had, I would say, to my knowledge, AI-only businesses, but we have businesses that are learning how to use AI and facilitating their businesses through AI. You know, I think at this point, it's been more use of AI as opposed to AI as their fundamental business premise. My guess is that will evolve over time, and I would expect that we would have more businesses that are kind of fundamental AI businesses as AI continues to be a bigger piece of the economy.
Yeah, agreed. I could definitely see AI startup companies saying, well, I'm going to do AI a different way, and I'm going to focus on this little manufacturing area, let's say.
My guess is that any business that wants to grow in this environment has to at least be thinking about AI. Do you think that's right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you're whether you're a big business or a small
exactly.
business, this tooling will be powerful, for you. And I think the challenge for all businesses, large and small alike, is trying to figure out how to use it less effectively. What are the best use cases? You know, the challenge for small businesses is, I think, developing what those use cases are and then, you know, being able to afford the compute power. You know, one of the challenges with AI at the moment is the compute power is expensive. And so, you know, the question is, are there off-the-shelf apps, applications, and other capabilities that one can utilize as a small business? And or how do you access, you know, the most powerful components of AI, you know, without massive financial resources?
And so looking inside Goldman Sachs, since we're on AI, is Goldman Sachs using AI for asset management, risk management, and GSAM portfolio management?
We're using AI in any number of components of the firm. You know, it kind of runs the gamut from things that make the firm more efficient and generate a lot of productivity in the operations of the firm, all the way through to, as you said, areas that would really touch the client, whether it's in our investment business where we can, you know, say in a quantitative investment strategy where we can actually train models that allow us to deliver better investment performance. You know, in our markets business, we have a platform that we call Marquee, which is a digital platform that allows for a lot of analytical power for our clients to use based on a lot of the historical market data information that we've, you know, gathered over the years in our firm. And, you know, you can use AI to power that analytic to be even more, you know, more useful for the client. So that would be an example. In our investment banking business, we're using AI, you know, in terms of looking at, you know, back testing transactions and valuations and trends, and having a little bit more robust perspective on, you know, what's happened historically and what the predictive power of that might be going forward. So that, those are some examples. And then on the efficiency side, we're finding areas to take otherwise relatively, you know, bespoke, kind of very human-driven processes and try to increase the technology quotient in there to make those processes more automated, faster, more efficient, more reliable, allows you to scale, you know, more significantly on top of that, you know, that process, which is no longer quite as human-dependent and has a bit more automation as part of it.
Yeah, hopefully we have a listener out there who's throwing around the idea that they want to start an AI business. How would they learn about the 10,000 Small Business Program, and how would they apply? And I believe next spring is the application deadline?
Yeah, yes, that's correct. I think the best way to apply to our program is probably to come to our website and look at the Goldman Sachs website. We also in various communities, you know, find ways through partnerships with cities and mayors, economic development authorities to put out feelers, if you will, to try to find people that are running businesses. So it's probably one or both ways, but I think our website is a good place to start.
And if you had a crystal ball, what does the future of Utah and Goldman Sachs look like?
We have close to 4,000 people working in our Salt Lake offices. You know, we've got a significant amount of the operations of the firm. I mean, I would say it'd be very hard to operate Goldman Sachs without going through Utah at this point. So, you know, it's become much more of a mainstream part of the operational integrity of our firm. You know, every major area of the firm essentially is represented in Utah, whether it's risk, compliance, controllers, treasury, obviously technology, and many others, asset management, you know, banking and markets. So, you know, we deem Utah to be pretty critical to the operations of the firm. And obviously, given that, we intend to keep growing, you know, growing that presence and also making sure that it's ever more integrated into the central part of how we run the firm. So, you know, as we become more efficient, use more AI, drive more productivity, Utah will be a big driver of that and a big beneficiary of that.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would just say, you know, we have had a wonderful experience in Utah. The state has been an extraordinary, state and the city of Salt Lake have been extraordinary partners. We could not have had this level of success without that partnership. I think it's a great example of a public-private partnership. It's certainly benefited Goldman Sachs. I think it's benefited the state of Utah. As per your questions about 10,000 small businesses, we've tried to do our part to give back to the city of Salt Lake and to the state of Utah and invest back in entrepreneurship and small business owners in the state, which we think is an important part of growing the state's economy and obviously the United States economy. And so we're proud to be doing that, but it wouldn't happen without a strong partnership with the governmental sector and the city and the state, and we're very pleased with that and appreciative of it and look forward to 25 more good years ahead.
All right. We've been speaking with John Waldron. He's the president and COO of Goldman Sachs. John, thanks for spending time with us this morning.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we are back.
So, the many candidate signs in town are thankfully being replaced, as the election will be over tomorrow, by orange Live PC, Give PC signs.
Yay!
Here to talk about KPCW's in that event, we have our president and general manager, Juliana Alley. Thanks for coming in, Juliana.
Sure, good morning. Happy to be here.
And, you know, even the windows here at KPCW are festooned with Live PC, Give PC. It's a big community event, isn't it?
It's a huge community event. We're so excited to partner with the Park City Community Foundation and really lean into this event. It just brings the community together. And yeah, Roger, as you said, our windows are decorated in orange and huge letters. We're so thankful to Anna Nazzoni, one of our weekend DJs who has a real beautiful artistic flair, just offered to fancy us up this time around. So we're really appreciative to her and happy to continue the community engagement and community sort of marketing of this amazing one day of giving.
Okay, so someone just moved here a week ago, let's say.
Yeah.
And they keep hearing this Live PC, Give PC. How could you describe it in two or three sentences?
I felt that way, I guess, but 10 years ago, I guess we've been here longer than LiveGive has, actually, now that I think about that. 10 years ago as a KPCW employee, though. But it is still, a little bit of a, what is all this orange, as you guys have been saying? Halloween's over. But it is this amazing community event that all the nonprofits in the surrounding area can participate in. You just need to go to the Community Foundation's website. I think it's too late now. But you can always plan for next year to engage with the Community Foundation, and they will help you get organized and help you put together a page on their website so that anybody and everybody who wants to give to a cause can do it that day. You can go on to the Community Foundation's website, and I think there's nearly 140 nonprofits that are participating now. KPCW, of course, is one of them. And you can sort of pick and choose the ones that are your favorite and that you want to be able to support. I think $5 is the lowest donation that they're willing to accept. And so it's just great to see everyone come out. They're looking for any and all donations. I think that their goal is over $5 million this year, which is amazing. But of course, they're also looking for that kind of engagement, right? To get anybody who wants to be able to give $5 to 17 different organizations and be able to show their support for all the little guys out there. It's a great way to do it.
So if you had a $100 bill burning a hole in your pocket, you could donate that $100, $5, to 20 different and really feel like you've made a bit of a difference.
And you shouldn't just feel that way. You have made a difference. By engaging with that nonprofit, engaging with the community this way, you are feeling that love and you are expressing that love back to the community, and we're so appreciative.
And one of the things they do so well is there's a momentum and an excitement surrounding the day. There are leaderboards that move, and there are matching grants that get announced, and there are power hours and all these wonderful things that they do. It's really a remarkable, it's a well-run operation and a lot of fun to participate in.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned matching grants, because as I said, KPCW is a member, is a nonprofit that is happy to receive your support that day. And our goal is $100,000, and we are chugging away at that goal. So thank you so much for anyone who's already given, because that is one beautiful thing about this. Although it is a one-day kind of event, you can go ahead and make donations now. But we've got two matching grants we're super excited about. One from NewsMatch. They are a part of Institute for Nonprofit News Organization that supports local and smaller news organizations. And so we're so thankful for their match, as well as the Carnegie Corporation and William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. They've also given us a match. So we're really excited to be able to leverage those two generous donations. And if we are able to, if our community is able to match those dollars, you know, we're going to receive all of that and we'll be well on our way, you know, and hopefully even exceed our $100,000 goal. Because as much community support as we received during that whole horrible rescission timing at late fall or late summer, you know, at the end of July into early August, we heard from the community how much you value KPCW and support what we're doing here, and you need our services, whether it's the news and information, it's the awesome music, it's the engaging interviews that you two do, or the lost and found, just getting yourself connected to your things. Those things that you community value, we're so appreciative. I heard from you then, but we always need to hear from you, right? Because we are keeping the lights on, we are keeping the music spinning. You know, we always need to hear from all of you folks out there to keep our operations going.
Okay, so backing up just a moment. So you'd mentioned the Community Foundation website. So that is for not-for-profits to enroll or engage with them so that they could be on the Live PC, Give PC. So now we're talking about the livepcgiveps.org site. So that's where people can go now.
Yep, you can go there now and you can see all of those 140 some odd nonprofits, including KPCW, to make your donations there.
And can you see all the matching grants on there as well?
I'm not sure about that.
Well, let's take a look.
It's possible that once you find the nonprofit you believe in and you click on their sort of their page within the Community Foundation's page, you'll see some more detailed information about why, you know, the mission of that organization and why supporting them is an amazing thing to do.
You know, we don't like to be irritating, but we do ask for money several times a year.
Yeah.
Okay? We ask. We have our pledge drives, and now it's Live PC, Give PC. Let's talk a little bit about why we have to do that, Juliana. What does it take to keep the lights on here?
Well, it's just certainly. So there's, you know, a lot of expensive equipment here. We've got our three towers, our three main areas where our towers are broadcasting all of this great information throughout Summit and Wasatch counties. You know, we're covering the entire Wasatch back. It's, you know, upwards of 80,000 households that our listening audience are tuning in. And so that equipment and those personnel to keep that equipment up and running is very expensive. And, you know, things happen. Equipment ages. You know, during the summer, our team, the production team, always goes up and makes site visits to take a look at the equipment and make sure everything's running smoothly. And they inevitably come away with a, hey, we kind of, hey, can we please get A? Can we please have A? We need to upgrade this. We need to upgrade that. And, you know, I want to make sure that we have got, I wouldn't say state of the art, but that we've got excellent equipment to make sure that all of the information that we need to send out to our listening audience is getting out there, whether it's an emergency alert, an update on traffic, an update on a moose crossing or elk crossing. You know, you guys are hearing it clean and static free, or you're getting it immediately through the streaming services that we provide.
And of course, another big expense is the people that we have to hire. In order to do the news coverage that you can see every day for free in the local or hear every day for free in our newscasts, we got to pay reporters.
We need to pay the reporting team. Absolutely. We're so thankful for all of them and their hard work, because there's a lot of information out there. There's a lot of, you know, as you mentioned, tomorrow is election day, right? And they've been on top of it this, you know, for weeks now, covering the various candidates, making sure that everyone's got information so that they can make an informed decision about their vote. It's so important to vote, so please go vote. We've had forums in Heber City. We co-hosted a forum, the first KPCW's first ever forum down there. We were so thrilled to do with the Heber City Leadership Academy, and it was amazing. It was great. You know, we continue to do that with the Park Record up here and covering Park City and Summit County legislative kind of events and elections. So yeah, there's a lot of work going on here. We're a busy hive.
We send people to all those long meetings at the Planning Commission and the Park City Council. We send people so you don't have to go, and you can still find out what happened.
Yes, we do the homework for you. So now is an amazing time to give to the station. If you haven't given before, please find us at kpcw.org or find us on the Community Foundation's website. And it's an amazing time to join the Broadcaster Club. I always have my Broadcaster Club membership tied to Live PC, Give PC. So I'm up for renewal this month, and I'll be thrilled to do that because I just feel like I'm making even more of a difference. Not only am I supporting KPCW, I'm supporting the community and helping the foundation get to that goal that they have to know how engaged and supportive this community is.
Who knows exactly when Live PC, Give PC, Give PC began? Is it 14 years?
I feel like it's 15. I heard Christine Coleman talking yesterday morning, and so I bet we can probably figure all of that out. And I know she's going to be on a bunch this week, I think.
Yeah, we will continue. Yes. Mm-hmm. One of the other things that we do, in addition to sort of reminding people that we are a participant, we do a lot of things to support Live PC, Give PC. There are a number of media hits that will be happening. I know Joel Zero will be on Friday morning. I know I'll have somebody on, I think it's Christine, on the local news hour. So we will continue to try to promote. And we'll continue to, not try, we'll continue to promote.
Exactly. We'll have a live remote at the library party on Friday afternoon. Claire Wiley in the Local View will be there, broadcasting and telling everybody about the fun and keeping them updated on how well the foundation is doing and if we've got to that goal yet.
Yeah, you got it. 15 years. I just looked at the website.
Awesome. Okay.
That's a long time.
It is a long time, but amazing, amazing work.
Exactly. Well, this has been Mountain Money, and we cannot do
this.
First,
we have to thank Juliana. Juliana.
No thanks, necessary, guys.
Thanks, Juliana. Please subscribe to the Mountain Money podcast to stay on top of all the latest episodes of KPCW's Mountain Money.
If you have any ideas for Mountain Money, please shoot us an email at mountainmoney@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.